Hi, friends.
Hello, should I delete that, listeners?
We still have some tickets left for our live tour and we would absolutely love to see you there.
On Thursday, the 23rd of May, we will be performing in the London Islington Assembly Hall.
On Monday, the 27th of May, we will be in Salford.
On Tuesday, the 28th of May, we'll be in Glasgow.
Sunday, the 2nd of June, Birmingham.
Monday, the 3rd of June, Bristol.
And Tuesday, the 4th of June in Southampton.
You can get your tickets at aegpresents.co.uk or via the link in the show notes or our Instagram bios.
We really hope we see you there.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So weird.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to the show.
It feels like role reversal, but not for you, but for me. But then also for you.
Yeah, you're in the hot seat. How do you feel?
Yeah, really weird.
Hello everyone. Welcome back to the Should I Delete That podcast. We have a special episode today because what day is it, please? Drum roll. That'll be a terrible sound.
Oh, yeah, everyone's like, ow! Stop it!
But today, your book comes out!
It does! It's launch day, finally!
Thursday! I fucking love a Thursday!
I can't believe
your book's
it!
Book's out!
I know!
You're a published author. By the time people will be listening to this, you'll be minus one in the charts. You'll be so high, you'll be setting records.
Minus one!
Wow, she's amazing! And we're doing a special episode. Normally, the Thursday episode is the Is It Just Me episode. But today we've got a day celebrating you and I get to interview you.
I know, but I promise it will be interesting. It's not just like all about the
books. You can't promise them that.
I can't promise that.
Don't start with a lie. Be honest, it might be interesting. You might find this
being really interesting. Try my best to be interesting.
But no, I'm really excited about this because we talked about it last week about how this book, obviously it's everything you live and breathe, right? Like it's about diet culture, it's about recovery from diet culture, from disordered eating, from eating disorders, from like all of the shit that so many women have carried for so long. And it's about like freeing yourself from the like shackles of diet culture, which is something that maybe we take for granted because we're in this space.
Totally.
But it's so powerful and so exciting and it's here.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you some questions today to people who maybe don't understand, like, why, you know, what even, okay, I'm going to start with this. In your language, in your head, what do you think diet culture means? Because it feels like a bit of like a buzzword that the boomers don't understand. So.
It's a buzzword. So basically, diet culture, I guess, the best way I can think to sum it up is like a set of beliefs that thinness is the best thing that a human can achieve, and that thinness equates to happiness and success and desirability and lovability, and that we all need to be thin, essentially. And we all live in a diet culture, particularly in the West. It's very strong, and we're very entrenched in diet culture here. And it's been around for actually like a really, really long time. And the only reason it's around, or the reason it thrives today, is because it makes so many people so much money.
Yeah.
It's I butcher the statistic, but I believe it's $192 billion industry worldwide, which is an insane amount of money. Like I can't really grasp how much money that is, but it's a lot. So like there's a good reason that diet culture exists and it thrives and it's so prevalent, because it's money making. It's a huge money maker.
So in terms of how people are making money from diet culture, like the brands and the products, like can you give us an example of like the things that exist that are marketed or sold as being products that we're told that we need, right? That diet culture creates.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a vast array of different products. You have everything from like anti-cellulite creams.
Do they work?
No. And I was writing this morning a feature about cellulite, and you know, 90%, I think it's 80 to 90% of women have it. but only less than 10% of men, which is convenient. So of course it's a woman problem. And it was cellulite. It was a word that didn't even exist to define it until the late 60s. And it was basically coined cellulite, and then became something like another way for women to hate themselves, and another way for brands to make money. Because, oh gosh, you shouldn't have cellulite. Like, here's something that you can fix. Used to fix it. So like cellulite creams, weight loss products, weight loss tablets, waist trainers, anything that's going to change your appearance or fix your appearance, and even stuff that doesn't explicitly say this is for weight loss. Like, diet culture is very clever and sneaky, and they, you know, have a huge, like, incredible marketing power behind it, who keeps up with the current climate and, you know, realizes, oh, you know, we can't be as overt with our messaging nowadays, so we're gonna, like, package it up as balance or wellness or well-being,
a lifestyle change.
Yeah, right, exactly. And then, like, yeah, a lifestyle change, or like a gym, you know, get in shape.
You know, what shape?
What shape?
Triangle.
No,
no, hexagon. But there's also, within that, there's other products as well, right, that, like, already exist that are then being used. And I mean products when I say, like, an apple, or, like, there's ridiculous things about existing things, like, oh, drinking more water so that you can not be hungry. So there's stuff like, just like, who is doing the marketing for apples that, like, so, oh, you have to eat an apple every day and that will help. And it's, like, I mean, that must come from dietitians, I suppose, like, or PTs. The amount of PTs, particularly on Instagram, offer, like, unsolicited, or not unsolicited, but nutritional stuff that they don't necessarily have the training for.
Right.
And that's because everybody wants an answer, right? That's the thing with diet culture.
Exactly. And with anything like that, if you drill down, you'll find that people are making money from it somehow. So, like, the PTs, they're doing it. They're offering this, you know, this advice, like nutritional advice, but at the end of the day, they want to sell their plan, or they want to get more clients. And it, often in magazines, we'd get the, like, it's you that you used to eat an apple every morning, right?
Yes, I did. No, not every morning, before every meal. Before every meal,
okay.
Yeah.
And I did half a grapefruit. I
fucking love a grapefruit. And they are not spicy, sour. That's a lot to do every time. It's like, oh god,
it was. Like, it would go in my eyes all the time. I was, like, constantly bloodshot. But and unsurprisingly, didn't lose weight, not thin. So
can I ask, like, I'm going to ask this as it. I hate people that say I'm going to be a devil's advocate, because the devil doesn't need an advocate because he's the devil. But I'm going to ask this like a boomer. I'm going to be a boomer advocate, right? Mm-hmm. Because there are people, there are, like, the Piers Morgans of the world with the school of thought that's like, okay, well, there's an obesity crisis in the UK, for example, and potentially maybe that is more dangerous than diet culture. Now, that's something for people to debate and whatever. So I'm not asking you to answer that, because it's an impossible question. But I think people need to understand the dangers that come with diet culture, because people think that it's a celebration of obesity, right? That's what the boomers basically say sometimes, you know, whenever we see, like, plus size women on a magazine cover or whatever, they're like, oh, well, you're just promoting obesity and blah, blah, blah. But I think, like, in order to understand why that's not the case, people need to understand why diet culture is so dangerous. So could you please explain, like, the life-threatening dangers of diet culture?
So, yeah, we have that Piers Morgan narrative, like, obesity is bad, obesity is dangerous. Obesity, and I'm saying this in air quotes, because the science behind obesity being unhealthy is not what we think it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
We think, according to our, you know, medical knowledge and our medical system, which adopts a very weight normative approach, we think that anyone that is in the overweight category, which is over 30 on the BMI scale, is then unhealthy, right? Mm-hmm. And then if you go obviously higher and higher and higher, the more unhealthy it gets. And actually, like, yes, and I'm not a scientist and I'm not a doctor. And yes, some fat is linked to bad things like that, you know, to health problems. Like, we can't get away from that. But you can't just look at a person who's fat and say that they're unhealthy, because you just don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
You have no idea. And only their doctor knows that. Like, and them, you have absolutely no idea. So we can't just go around deeming people unhealthy when there are when we don't give that same energy to thin people, like if we just see thin people, why do we assume that they're healthy? We have absolutely no idea, and mm-hmm. health encompasses so much more than what you weigh. So there's that, and then this whole, you know, promoting obesity thing, like, what is the alternative for those people? Do they want fat women to be shut away and kept in on the margins of society and not be represented and not be shown and not be seen? Is that what they want? Yes, I'm guessing so, because if they're complaining about them being like celebrated and shown, then I'm guessing that's what they want. And what does that cultivate? Shame. And shame is, you know, and I'm using this, I'm applying this to their logic. I'm not saying that fat women need to lose weight, but by their logic, they want this obesity crisis gone and people to be thin. But shame, is science has proven again and again, is not an effective motivator. Mm. It doesn't help in any way. Fat women being ashamed and feeling like they have to lose weight to fit in and feeling shamed into losing weight is not going to make them lose weight, because we know shame is not an effective motivator. Mm-hmm. So they're just left on the margins of society feeling ashamed, alone, and it's not productive for anything or anyone. It's cruel.
No.
And those women finally that have never been able to see themselves represented or seen anywhere in the media, anywhere, like they finally can see themselves. And like, I'm actually referring that, I'm thinking in my head about the Tess Holliday cover, which is what was so controversial. Mm-hmm. And that cover meant so much to so many women, because yeah, they'd never seen themselves be celebrated. And it doesn't mean that everyone in the world is looking at covers like that and thinking, oh, this means I have to be fat like her, I'm gonna get fat like her. Like, don't be stupid. Like, our society is so incredibly fat phobic. Mm. We're not gonna see a few fat women be celebrated and the whole society then wants to be fat. That's not how it works, because it's so ingrained in the fabric of our society that fat is bad and that fat is the worst thing that you can be and that you have to be thin. So it is just like plain ridiculous to me that people say that it's promoting obesity. Like, no, it's just allowing people who have been previously marginalised to be seen and celebrated and are just allowed to exist. Mm. Right?
And I think like a really big part, this is like not an interviewer thing, but I'm just gonna say, on the men that make these comments, I think it's so often, like, first of all, because slimmer women have been considered to be more attractive, right, by society, mm. that's why these men are like, well, just be this. But I think a massive part of the men that say this, and it's making women smaller because it's convenient that women are smaller, and I think like that's a really big part of the diet culture stuff. And it's like, just seeing women like celebrate themselves, everyone's like, fuck, I'm losing all this money, like, these women aren't going to need my approval, they're just going to go out and exist and be happy on their own, and like, oh god, like, and it sends these people into a real spin.
Totally. And like, I think diet culture is underpinned by the patriarchy,
mm.
because it keeps women busy and obedient and so busy. Like, think about when you're on a diet, and I'm thinking about when I was on a diet, I had absolutely no mental or physical capacity for anything but focusing on like not eating,
yeah,
or like eating a certain way. So it's a good trick for the patriarchy. It works for the patriarchy.
And like, on your dieting and like your experience with it, like, I think we said this in an episode a couple of weeks ago, that the women that put themselves at the forefront of the fight against diet culture are often the ones that have been hurt by it the most.
Yeah.
And your experience is like certainly the case. Like, mm. and you've documented your recovery from anorexia and your like freedom from diet culture so spectacularly on Instagram, and it's been so valuable. But I think, like, you know, anybody who's new to your page now might not know where you've come from. So if you could, like, what's the biggest driver for this book in terms of your own personal experience of diet culture?
Yeah, and you know what? And it's nice that this is more informal, because like whenever I'm asked this, I find it so hard to condense it into like a little answer, because it just feels like something that's been going on in my life since I can ever remember. Well, I was a chubby kid, just for lack of a better word. I don't know how else to say it. Like, I wasn't fat, but I definitely wasn't thin, and I was chubby, and I developed before everyone else. Like, I had boobs and everyone was fascinated about it, and I just wanted to like I wanted the ground to like swallow me up. I hated it. And I was aware that my body felt bigger, and I became increasingly aware that bigger was bad. And so from the moment that I realized that food manipulates how your body looks, like you can use food to manipulate how your body looks and you can make it thinner via food, from the moment I realized that, I was just on a diet then for like years and years and years and years. And I tried like every single diet under the sun, like you name it, I have tried it, like some worse than others. Atkins is one that was horrendous. I was like grey, my face was actually grey. My mum said my face looked like off bread, and it really did. It was just like grey and horror. It was really, really awful. And then in my early 20s, and I started a job at a magazine, and I guess it was, I was thrown into a more like glamorous world in fashion. I was doing fashion, and obviously like fashion is so, I mean, fashion is almost like synonymous with thin. Mm. And so those beliefs became even more ingrained. And eventually it was a juice diet, I think, that really tipped me over from disordered eating into eating disorder. And then I just basically stopped eating from then. But recovery was really long. And I want to stress that, because I feel like people think, oh, then you get, you know, like young, thin, you know, very thin white woman, like gets eating disorder, gets help, like recovers. But my story wasn't like that. And I really want to stress that, because I don't think there's enough of those like quasi recovery stories. We don't hear enough about those. I'd only ever heard of like success stories, like instant success stories. And mine wasn't like that at all. It my anorexia then morphed into bulimia for years, and then into binge eating disorder. And it was really only a few years ago that I actually managed to, you know, recover.
Yeah, I suppose people think that it's like, with most things, like you get a diagnosis, you get the treatment, like an antibiotic, and then you're better.
Yeah.
But I guess a big part of the fact that it's a mental health condition is that you also need to want to get better. And yeah. And there's so much to it that people, I think, maybe because we're so shit at talking about mental health in the UK, that we just won't even entertain the conversation. But can I ask, like, how your diagnosis came to be, how it was approached by you or by your family or by your healthcare professionals? Because so many people exist with disordered eating, with eating disorders, and they just, like, you know, everybody's journey is so different.
So different. I mean, do you know what? It feels like a blur now. Back then when I first got the diagnosis, and it was my mum, she was like, something is really not right with you. I remember her saying, like, the lights are off with you completely. Like, there's just no one home. And there wasn't. I was in, like, people call it a prison, an eating disorder. And that is exactly what it feels like. It's like a mental prison. And you're just so trapped and consumed by food and weight and body. And I was on and off the scales like 5 times a day, and I existed on like boiled sweets, like sucking boiled sweets, like that would help alleviate my hunger pains. And then, yeah, my mum was like, we need to take you to the doctors. And I was really lucky because I had private medical through my work. And this is also why I like telling the story a bit like, oh, because it's so hard for anyone listening who does need to access help and they don't have private medical, they can't afford private medical, because it's, you know, the NHS, like, it's dire, the situation, and your BMI has to be life-threateningly low for you to access help. And then even if you do, it's only like 12 sessions of CBT, and it, in my experience at least, like, that is not sufficient. So I was very lucky. I was really lucky to access therapy and sustained therapy, which is what I needed, because it was just really, yeah, I mean, it is with everybody, though. It's deep-seated with anybody, but it took me a really long time to come out of it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah. I wonder for you, was it like a shameful thing within your friendship groups or within your family, or something that you were able to talk about? Because obviously you speak about it so publicly now, but was it always easy for you to do that?
No. And you know what? When I don't really know what possessed me to do this, but when I spoke about it on Instagram, I'd still never spoken to my friends about it or my sisters about it, like my mum and a little bit my dad. And that was literally it. It was such a secret. But I didn't just keep that secret because I felt ashamed. That was part of it. I felt very ashamed, but also an eating disorder is weird, but it almost feels like your private best friend that is only you know about, and it's personal and intimate, and it's a false sense of security and comfort, a totally false sense. And telling that secret feels so scary because you're like, I'm going to lose this best friend that's been with me for so long and who's there in my darkest days, even though
they are your darkest days.
Yeah. So I was just, I just didn't want to tell. And I don't even know how it happened or why I decided to do it, but it's true like that. I can't remember who, I think is it Brené Brown, talks about like how telling a secret releases so much power and takes away the power of the secret, and it's like so true.
Because the thing with anorexia that is terrifying is it has the highest mortality rate of any mental health condition.
Yeah.
And is there anything that you would say to somebody who doesn't understand the real danger of anorexia?
I mean, like you said, it's the psychiatric disorder with the highest mortality rate, and yet it's still commonly seen as a vanity illness. Mm. People think, oh, you just want to be thin because you're vain and you want to look good. And I think that is a reason that there's so much stigma and shame around it as well. And that's definitely what I felt. I thought, like, God, I am so vain. Like, I am so vain that I want to be thin, and I'm spending, I am dedicating my entire life to trying to be thin. Like, how vain am I? And it's actually a really, really serious illness. But I think people really distance like disordered eating and dieting from eating disorders. And I don't think that's a good thing to do, because I think the line is thinner than we realise. Yeah, so the line is thinner than people think, and actually NEDA, which is the National Eating Disorder Association, they did some research which showed that people who engage in moderate dieting are 5 times more likely to develop an eating disorder, and people who engage in extreme dieting are 18 times more likely to develop an eating disorder. So the path is very clear, and you know, eating disorders are very complex. I'm not saying like, oh, if you diet, you're going to get an eating disorder. You know, people have to be, I think, I'm not a scientist, but I think people have to be susceptible as well. And there are certain like personality traits that make people more susceptible to developing an eating disorder, like perfectionism. There's like all or nothing tendencies. But the path from disordered eating and dieting to, and that's what dieting is disordered eating, of course. That path from disordered eating to eating disorders is very clear.
Yeah.
And I don't think that enough is acknowledged. I don't think that's acknowledged enough.
I think in the same way that Britain's binge drinking culture enables alcoholics to exist quite easily within society, it kind of feels like the same with dieting. The fact that everybody's on a diet, everybody's going to be good on Monday, everybody's avoiding the bad snacks, it does mean that people with a functioning eating disorder can exist kind of normally.
Totally.
And like you mentioned before that you were working in fashion, like I don't think we could underestimate how normalised size zero is. Like haute couture, close your eyes and think of couture, because it's size zero.
Right.
Like, that's it. And, like, this is it. Like, I think, you know, like you say, a lot of people with eating disorders are susceptible to them for so many things, and often it can be other things that you're craving control of, and it's so many complexities, and it's not all about food, but this is a culture that is creating such an extraordinary focus on thinness that it's surely inevitable. And I wonder, like, your fashion and beauty, like, do you think that was a a big, I mean, was it common? Like, because the food talk must have just been crazy working for a magazine like that.
Crazy. And dieting isn't just, like, dieting is glamorized. It really is. And so, and thinness is as well. I mean, nothing tastes as good as skinny feels.
Yeah,
like,
that was my mantra. Emily Blunt's line in Devil Wears Prada, and it's just like, I'm one cube of cheese away from my goal weight. And I'm like, what the fuck?
I know.
And I was like, I can't. It was like, oh my God.
I know. It was really, really glamorized. And like that, you know, it was, and still is, unfortunately. Like, maybe less to a lesser extent now, but. And especially, yeah, I mean, it was, you had to be thin to be successful in fashion. Like, you just had to be thin.
Mm.
And I think a lot of that, I think those messages and beliefs were already internalized, but it was compounded by the fashion industry and how it was just like, it felt like everything was screaming at me, like, thin, thin, you have to be thin, you're not thin enough.
Mm.
I would go to, like, parties, like, you know, I was just out of uni and, like, going to all these fancy parties and obviously loving it. Like, I was like, oh my God, like, living in London, like, this is so cool. And realising that, like, gosh, these people are so thin, I need to be thinner. I'm obviously not thin enough, there's something wrong with me. And
mm.
I was just getting thinner and thinner and thinner. But the atmosphere in the environment in around me was such that people didn't know that I had a problem until it was really, really bad.
Mm.
But they didn't know I had a problem because it was just so normalized, you know, like, oh, I'm skipping lunch today, trying to be good, or just having like a bit of broth for my lunch, or I'm just juicing. You know, we'd all juice in the office. Like, it was just normal.
Mm.
So people didn't realize until it got really bad because, yeah.
And so we kind of recognise the dangers at both ends of the scale, right? We recognise the dangers with obesity, like you say. You know, there are medical, there can be medical ramifications that come from somebody being overweight.
Yeah.
In the same way that there can be those that come from people being underweight, right? Like, so it's a huge spectrum. But I think something that's fascinating is the middle bit, because I want to understand, I would like you to help people to understand what it is when you take away the mortality element and the severe, you know, diagnosable mental health sides of this, and you just look at it as the elusive diet culture. Can we understand the dangers of that? Because when you take away, you know, people are very quick to use, like, well, people are dying, or people are, you know, and hospitalization rates, and if you take away all of that and we just look at the normal people caught up in the middle of this,
yeah,
can we understand the dangers of that?
Yes. I did a section in the book, and this isn't just me plugging, but like,
this is the point of the episode, so plug. This is the only time.
Okay, yeah, really. And it's, are you a chronic dieter? And it's like a week in the life of a dieter, and it's like, on Sunday night, diet starts Monday, diet starts tomorrow, you're going to throw everything away.
I used to do that. I used to drive back to London after my mum's, come back from my mum's house, and I don't know why I went there every weekend, it was weird, but and I would just document in my head, I'm not going to eat.
Yeah.
Like, a few years ago.
And did you eat loads on Sunday?
Yeah. I literally 30 roast potatoes, because I'm like, this will see me through.
Yeah, because you know, which obviously makes no sense. No, it's like counterproductive to your actual goal.
In the morning, and then anyway.
Yeah. And then you start a diet on Monday, and then it carries on Tuesday and Wednesday, and your enthusiasm naturally wanes because it's not willpower. Like, our bodies are very clever, which is a good thing, and they want to keep us going. And so when they're being starved, they're like, ah, what are you doing? Like, I need food. So it's a perfectly normal biological response. And then we end up eating a lot on the weekend, and then the cycle continues all over again, and it's so miserable, like, so miserable. As I was writing the chapter, I remembered, like, all the Sundays that were just so painful, and I was like, I'm doing this again, I can't believe I'm doing this again.
Mm.
A little part of me was like, if it hasn't worked before, why is it going to work now? But I couldn't, I needed hope, because I was like, I can't stay like this, I need the hope. So I shoved that part away and just kept going. But it's so detrimental to your life, like, not only mentally, because it zaps you, it drains you of energy, and it can impact your social life. You know, like, I can't, I'd love to go to that restaurant, but I'm on this, like, low-carb diet, whatever.
Yeah.
It can zap your social, and it can impact your career and your working life and your intellectual functioning. And physically, it's not good either. Like, the shit that we do to our bodies is really, really... It's just not good. They're not supposed to live like that. They're supposed to be consistently nourished and kept alive. Like, not to be messed with every week trying this diet and then that diet. And it's just... It's really horrible to be fighting your reality, which is what so many of us do when we're not liking how we look and we're dieting or we're being good or whatever. Mm. We're fighting our reality and it's painful and it hurts. And it's probably more painful than a lot of people listening probably actually realise until they were sort of thinking about it and really honest with it and looked at, like, what would my life look like if I had the body that I was super happy with?
Mm.
Like, what would my life look like? And actually, like, God, it would be a huge relief for so many people.
Mm.
And people think that in order for that to happen, they have to get the body of their dreams or their goal body. And it's just not true, as we know. It is not true. Like, it is a mind problem. It's not a body problem.
Mm.
Like, I thought there was no way on earth that I could accept my body when I was... I'm not going to say a specific weight, but, like, however many stone thinner. I was like, no, I still need to lose a stone or whatever. And now I'm that many stone heavier and I'm happy with my body. So that tells me that it isn't to do with my body. It was to do with my mind, and I've changed my mindset. But then I also realised that, I'm sorry, I'm going on a tangent, but, like, I also realised that it's easier said than done, and it's easy for me to sit here now and say, like, just be happy with your body as it is, because that's really hard to do. It's really hard to do, especially when it's so ingrained in us that fat phobia and diet culture, we're so conditioned that you just can't do that overnight. And I think, sorry, I will shut up in a second, but, like, I think for me that was part of the motivation for writing the book as well, is that there is a lot of, like, self-love and body love and body confidence stuff out there on Instagram, which is what I started doing, which is, like, here's my body, which is not marginalised by any means, but it's not the narrow, you know, standard of beauty that society dictates. And here it is, and I'm owning it, and I'm owning my cellulite and my stretch marks. And that stuff, I think, is so important and so necessary for people who don't feel represented and haven't historically felt represented. But I think what I realised is that is treating a symptom rather than the actual problem, which is diet culture and fat phobia and the patriarchy, which is at the root of all this stuff. So, like, we need to drill down to the, you know, it's okay to say, like, I love my body, you love yours. But, like, I think for me, like, when I really, really started to recover or really started to heal my body image was, like, this is why I feel this way. This is why I want to shrink my body. This is why I don't like my body. It's not innate in me. No. I wasn't born thinking, I'm too fat, I want to get thinner.
It feels innate because our mums have been on diets forever. Our teachers will have been telling us whatever. And now, even, you know, with calories on menus and whatever, like, all over the world, all over this country, all over the Western world, and people would be forgiven for thinking that it is innate.
Totally.
But you can unlearn it, right?
100%.
And do you believe you have unlearned everything, or do you think it's a consistent game of, hang on, I'm catching this thought, why do I think this thought? Oh, this is a bullshit thought, this is because of the page, and whatever.
100%.
And
yeah.
And that's easy for you to do now, right? It just...
Yeah. I think it's about, like, how long it takes me now. It's like, we're used to those thoughts would, like, send me spiralling and crashing, and I'd be, you know, at home in bed, like, I can't leave the house, I feel disgusting. And now I'm like, oh, I can catch that thought. But at the end of the day, like, I do think we have to be realistic as well and acknowledge that we can, you know, we've talked about this before, like, we can do this stuff day in, day out, and we can practice self-love and self-acceptance until we're, you know, until the cows come home. But at the end of the day, we live in a world where those values aren't necessarily reflected back at us.
Mm.
So we have to consistently rebel against that and fight against that. So it's always going to be a struggle. And I don't think it's realistic for anyone to be like, oh, I'm sick of hating my body, I'm going to love my body, and that's that. It's just not realistic. But I think that's okay.
I also think it's a very exciting thing. I think, like, this is the... I can't ever say things concisely, but if I was saying, like, to review your book, I think, like, or to recommend your book, and I think that the way that I would sell your book to a person, which is useful because that's what we're doing in this episode, would be to say that it's such an exciting prospect for people, because the way you're talking about disordered eating and the person that you describe as the one that does the diet and whatever, that was me, like 100%. It was, I was so immersed in this, and I used to lie in bed and like hurt myself grabbing my tummy rolls, like trying to be thinner, and like, and I think of when I wake up tomorrow, I'm gonna have a flat stomach and everything's gonna be better. And actually I realized that during this time I got a very flat stomach and I didn't even notice it, because I was still put, and now I look back at photos, I'm like, I was so thin, but I was still, you know, like I've been exactly where somebody who needs this book has been. And I guess maybe like I've just seen it in real time by following you and being your friend and being part of this space online and seeing it. But like, when I think back to where I was now versus the freedom that I have, it's properly exciting. Yeah. Like I just have come back from that holiday where I sat in a bikini and I ate and I had my tummy rolls out and so, and I didn't give a fuck.
No.
Because it wasn't worth it. Like on balance, okay, fine, it wasn't societally perfect, but on balance it wasn't worth ruining my holiday for.
Right.
And that's a choice that I get to make now, and I didn't get to make that choice before. And like, that's exciting.
That's,
and
so
that's
cool.
What I think this book is going to offer so many people is the chance to learn enough that they get to make these choices in their own lives.
Yeah.
And I'm so proud of you.
Oh,
and
thanks.
I think it's so exciting. And I'm really like, I don't know, I'm so optimistic for the future of all the readers of this book, because I just think that you're going to change their lives.
I hope so. I really do hope so. Yeah, I mean, I have, like, keep saying, I've thrown the kitchen sink out. Like, I've thrown at it, like, everything that has ever helped me and that I think could help someone else. And you can tell that I'm extremely passionate about all this stuff. And I just, yeah, I really hope it helps. And like, because I just think it's about time that women, all of us, and I know there is men as well, but there's just far greater pressure in this sense on women. I think it's time that we like just break free of this stuff, because whether it's whether you're dieting, disordered eating, eating disorder, all of it is all a mental prison, you know. A lot of them are more secure and like tighter than others, but at the end of the day, it's all a mental prison.
Some of it's like community service.
Yeah, exactly. But it's, at the end of the day, it's not nice. It's not pleasant for any of us, and we just don't need it. Like really, there is no actual real reason behind it. The reasons are all arbitrary, and I just want people to like want to help people see that.
Final thought, please, for a person that's picking up your book in their metaphorical bookstore online, they're hovering over, can you give them, sell it to them out?
Yes. So what I'll say is like, don't pick it up and be like, this is it, I'm gonna read it all and I'm gonna put everything into practice and then like, that's it, I'm cured, which is exactly what I would do because I have no chill and no control. But it's gonna take some time, and like, just take your time with it all, because there's a lot in there and there's a lot of different facets, and it's a lot of it is like quite complex. So give yourself time and compassion and like go easy with it. Like even if you only read like a chapter a week and like have a real think about it and like let it sink in and maybe, you know, read it twice, I don't know, but just be like very gentle with yourself. This stuff is hard and this journey is hard. I said I was reclaiming the word journey, didn't I? And I keep
air quoting it.
This journey is really difficult, so yeah, give yourself like space and compassion and go easy with it, and good luck. I just really hope that it helps, because you deserve a better life than what diet culture gives us.